This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Frankly, listeners want to tune out instantly when they hear politicians talk as though 1.5 degrees warming over pre-industrial is still possible. Many don't believe it. But we are being sold a climate future as though there is a workable plan. Thankfully, scientists are asking a lot of hard questions about that. Dr. Robin B. Lambole is part of a group checking official climate plans, among other things. Lambole has a PhD in physics of solar cells from the University of Cambridge and a master's in natural sciences. She led the paper Assessing the Size and Uncertainty of Remaining Carbon Budgets. That was published October 30th in Nature Climate Change, and there is no shortage of uncertainty about our climate future. From the Center for Environmental Policy at Imperial College London, Robin Lambole, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Your new paper and others you co-authored this year cross-check climate promises. Why is that worthwhile?
So governments have signed up to this Paris Agreement, which says that they're going to keep temperatures well below 2 degrees below pre-industrial and making efforts towards 1.5 degrees. So we need to check whether they're doing enough to actually keep to those promises. We can't say exactly who is and isn't, because that's a political problem rather than a physics problem, but we can sort of say, okay, given what's currently happening, what space is there to still keep to these promises? And, you know, are we on track at the moment?
Well, yes, the new paper is about the Remaining Carbon Budget, or RCB. What is that?
The Remaining Carbon Budget is the amount of CO2 that we can emit while still remaining at some probability of not passing a certain temperature threshold at a certain probability. So, for instance, the 1.5 degrees 50% budget would be the amount of carbon you can emit before we'd exceed a 50% chance of exceeding 1.5 degrees. The other carbon budgets of interest for the Paris Agreement would be 2 degrees targets. For this, you might talk about the 50% budget, but since the target is for well below 2 degrees, really you might want to look at one of those higher budgets, so maybe the 66%, 83%, or even 90% probability budgets that you're below 2 degrees.
Well, is it so late in climate change that we can only talk about having half a chance left of a really livable climate?
For 1.5 degrees, yes, I'm afraid even that budget is very small at the moment. I guess the question is more like, what do we consider to be a livable climate? I mean, certainly many areas of the globe will still be livable at 1.5 or even 2 degrees, but, you know, obviously some island nations will be submerged at those temperatures. And, different variations in, like, degrees of livability. I think it's important to, like, keep in mind that we're always talking about, like, fighting for some areas of land to retain their habitability and their being above sea level. But we're not really talking for any of these temperatures about, like, the entire world becoming uninhabitable.
Well, for the last few months, Earth is already 1.5 degrees hotter, and the World Meteorological Organization says that 1 year within the next five will be 1.5 degrees C, hotter than pre-industrial times. You have co-authored studies on this. Is the 1.5 degree target still worth talking about as an attainable future?
In the short run, it is very unlikely. I think that's fair to say now. When we talk about this 1.5 degree budget, it is important to note that that is the long run temperature. So to have a few months or even a whole year more than 1.5 degrees doesn't mean we've yet exceeded that temperature, because this is a temporary temperature, which includes both the human forcing and also natural variability. So the effects of, say, volcanoes and just yearly variation. So the fact that this year is hot is a combination of both human climate change and also some unusual phenomenon that we're hoping over the next few years would die back down to normal levels. There's obviously debate as to how much of which of the two is dominant. But we're most likely not above 1.5 degrees yet, but the space to remain below 1.5 degrees is really very small. I think it's fair to say that if it wasn't in the Paris Agreement, we wouldn't be talking about it quite so much as we are at the moment. But because it is in the Paris Agreement, there are suggestions, for instance, that we might exceed it and then return back down to it in which case it's still important to have a grasp of where it is in relation to our current status. And people are also saying, okay, so most likely we're going to exceed it, but we can still try and keep that exceedance probability as small as we can.
Well, according to the results of your paper, is the end of carbon burning before we pass 1.5 or 2 degrees very close in time?
Yes. So for 1.5 degrees, with our current rate of emissions, we're going to exceed that within the next 6 years. And really, we're down to only a little bit over 5 years now, since an awful lot of one of those years has elapsed and we haven't really reduced emissions over this year. It looks like emissions are going to be slightly up on last year. So for 1.5 degrees, yes, we're extremely close to that. For 2 degrees, actually, the budget change is much smaller. So we have lost a little bit of time compared to our previous estimate, but not as much as for the 1.5 degrees. We have obviously not been reducing emissions over the last 3 years. So obviously there was a small decrease due to COVID, but then we rebounded back up past where we were in 2019, even by 2021, and by 2022, and now looking like 2023, we're both marginally increasing on that again. So with record emissions levels, as we probably have this year and certainly had last year, the amount of time is rapidly decreasing. But for some probability of 2 degrees, so talking about maybe the 50% or the 90%, we have some manner of decades still before we're going to exceed that. And with a couple of decades, that still is compatible with net zero targets of 2050. And you do see governments with those targets already. So these are the same order of magnitude as current government commitments. So for the well below 2 degrees target, we're talking about governments doing what they've said they'll do rather than trying to persuade governments to sign up to much stronger conditions than they currently have, which obviously is still something we need to do. Like, governments don't necessarily always keep to their commitments, but it's a sort of different stage of the climate activism ladder, as it were.
So scientists set up climate models based on past observations within what is relatively reliably known, we hope. And now we experience events and speeds of change never seen before. It's possible important tipping points may be in the rear view mirror. What does that kind of bad news do to these plans from the International COP climate process?
We set it up using observations, both like the recent historical data and also sort of some signals from long-term like paleoclimate or the ancient climate data, and also from simulations of how we expect the world to work. All of these sorts of lines of evidence combine to give us some sort of like what's known as a prior distribution. This is what we'd expect. And then each year we receive new temperature data. This year's temperature data has obviously been very concerning. It's much hotter than we've ever seen before. And so you might say that over time, if we see this again next year, we should look to update our climate models quite substantially. 1 year's worth of data, however, is quite small compared to all of the data we have across the rest of history. So with only 1 year's extreme warming, we probably aren't going to change our numbers very much. Whereas if we see that for 2 or 3 or 5 years, we'll be looking at much stronger updates to our climate models.
Analyzing possibilities in such a complex world required breaking the problem into relatively solvable parts, and each sub-process has its own uncertainties and error margins. Adding them up as you do, I ask myself, are we talking about anything real? So I was relieved to find in the supplementary information, your group actually discusses the need for a sanity check, as you say. The whole process of remaining carbon budgets, it seems a little like alchemy to me.
Yeah, we think it's important to have like lots of different ways of calculating this to make sure that we're coming up with reasonable answers. So one of the sanity checks is to try and see how we do in our model compared to different climate models. But the actual idea behind the carbon budget is to minimize our reliance on any single climate model, because obviously all models have their flaws, and we want to see what statements we can make, which depends as minimally as possible on climate models. We do need to use climate models because there are so many different factors and it's impossible to assess all of them sort of by hand individually, particularly effects like aerosols, where the uncertainty in them is very large, and the way to judge how impactful aerosols are is very complicated. So we do use climate models and see how exceedance of 1.5 degrees would happen in various climate models. But the general idea of the carbon budget is to sort of divorce your thinking from having to be entirely reliant on climate models, all of which, of course, have their own individual flaws.
Your study and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change uses the idea of shared socioeconomic pathways, or SSPs. What are they, and do they change the amount of greenhouse gases allegedly left to burn?
Yes. So the SSPs are sort of ways to envision the world panning out. So SSP1 is like what happens if there are very low barriers to people going green, like the world puts a lot of effort in. SSP2 is the sort of middle of the road one. And I would say that the IPCC used to be very reliant on this framework, but over time it's become clear that we are developing most in line with an SSP2 world. And so nowadays people tend to focus on versions of SSP2 world. So SSP2 world has like middle of the road change in population, middle of the road enthusiasm for uptake of new technology, middle of the road middle of the road tendency towards, say, renewable energy rather than nuclear, middle of the road international cooperation. And by and large, that's been what we've seen over the last sort of 5 years or so. The other numbers are basically some sort of strong problem with trying to get international agreements to meet net zero targets, and then looking at how those problems play out in terms of the balance of greenhouse gases emitted. So most of these SSP worlds can meet the Paris Agreement to some extent. So you'll see, for instance, that in the SSP1 world, which is like the most green world, you can reach temperatures that are well below 1.5 degrees, whereas maybe in the SSP4 world, where there's a very high amount of like fighting between different nations, that's political fighting as well as possibly actual wars, you find that it's much more difficult to reach those very low temperature limits. Whereas by contrast, SSP5 is probably one of the most famous ones because this has the SSP585 pathway. This is the sort of boogeyman that's been used in a lot of climate modeling. It's the very high emissions, very high warming future scenario. People are now sort of trying to tend away from this being used in a way that it's considered as like a baseline or like a normal behavior because it's so different from how history has been panning out recently. But we still need to use some sort of social projection in order to get an estimate of aerosols and methane and other gases that are emitted. The carbon budget looks only at carbon emissions, but we know that carbon emissions correlate with a whole bunch of other emissions. Often, of course, like if people are getting their carbon from methane, there will be some leakage of that methane that's inevitable. When you burn the whatever methane or coal, you're going to create aerosols. So the precise amounts of these other gases emitted is hard to estimate precisely, but we know that it's going to correlate in some way with CO2. So we want to take account of those correlations when we're doing this model to say, you know, we have this much carbon budget. This is the limit, assuming that you do what we've vaguely predicted in these SSP projections would be a normal amount for a world where you're emitting this much carbon dioxide. There's not really a way around this, but we do a lot of robustness checks in the paper to see how much would it change if we, say, only used projections from one family of SSP emissions, or how would this change if you only use one single model of how society works, looking across different SSP worlds. And what we find is that it does matter, certainly for the 1.5 degree budget, because the budget is so small, you can easily change it by a factor of a half. However, for the larger budgets, it doesn't matter as much. And there's no sort of systematic tendency. It's not like if we use this model, you would always get a much larger budget. Or if we were in this SSP world, you would always have a much smaller budget. It's more that, you know, everything is so small, so minor differences just make a lot of difference to the results.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Robin Lambole from Imperial College London. We are talking about the amount of coal, gas, and oil you and I can burn before climate goes beyond the human niche. Well, media and politicians speak about carbon dioxide as the only greenhouse gas that matters, yet 25 to 30% of current warming is due to methane, just one of several non-CO2 gases. So I was pleased to see that you did address this in the paper. How did you handle non-CO2 inputs to these carbon budgets?
So what we do is we take an entire database of possible social projections for how society might change over time. And we look at how much they warm in each of these projections using two different climate models called MAGIC and FAIR. We take these estimates of total warming, and then we take the simulation where you take out all of the gases except CO2. You see how much it warms in a CO2-only world. And the difference between that and the one where you include all the other gases, this is known as the CO2 warming. So we compare the total warming to the CO2-only warming. And the difference between those is the non-CO2 effect. This also can include effects such as like the change in albedo from deforestation or effects like that, which are sort of not exactly CO2, but sort of, again, you would expect to relate to how much forest we're cutting down and therefore how much we're expecting to emit via burning and other sort of effects of that order. So these non-CO2 effects, we have to be dependent on a database of emission scenarios. But what we do to make sure we're not just dependent on the biases within that is to also check it against a different database of emission scenarios. And we find that for 1.5 degrees, this makes almost no difference at all, because there are just so few scenarios that show us meeting the 1.5 degree budget. And those scenarios are very strongly constrained in what you have to do in order to get there. For the 2 degrees budget, it matters distinctly more, but still doesn't really matter that much. So we have some degree of confidence that our estimates are quite reasonable, even if this is not to say that if we do more work to reduce methane emissions, you would get a larger effective carbon budget. But as things stand, we have reason to believe that the amount of effort we'll put into reducing methane emissions will be kind of in line with the amount of effort we put into reducing CO2 emissions.
Another major hinge point for the carbon budget is the date for net zero. And as they say in IPCC reports, I have low confidence in those promised dates, or even if net zero will happen. Talk to us about the net zero problems.
Yeah. So this latest paper doesn't attempt to say, you know, what the probability that governments will do what they say is. We simply calculate what you'd need to do. But in a previous paper that we produced, we looked at different governments, what are known as NDCs, nationally determined contributions, and see whether governments have put in practice legislation to actually enforce this, whether emissions are currently trending down, because if you sort of say you're going to be net zero by 2050, but your emissions are still going up, that looks a little bit suspicious. And you know, whether people have got plans for how they're going to go about getting to net zero. On the whole, we do unfortunately find that an awful lot of these net zero targets do not have very much by way of legal mechanisms to bring them about, which is not to say that governments are definitely not going to meet them, but at present we would have low confidence in them being followed. There's a limit to how much we can predict on this, because of course, you know, it depends who's in power, what they're doing, what the sort of general political appetite is for these things. And we are not experts on how society is going to pan out, but just from a sort of legal framework, we can say that an awful lot of governments don't look as though they are taking this as seriously in practice as they seem to be doing in paper.
As we speak, schools and businesses are closed in New Delhi, India, because the air is too toxic to breathe. And like China, the Indian government will face strong pressure to clean this pollution up. When they do, and other governments do that, what happens to the warming and to the carbon burning that we allowed ourselves?
So there are two different factors to consider here. Firstly, when people hopefully move away from coal, as you say, we see much cleaner air as a result from moving away from coal, although we also see cleaner air as a result of moving away from biomass burning. So India has the problem that there's pressure currently on a lot of people using biomass burning, which is very low in CO2 emissions, because the biomass is accumulated ultimately from plant growth, which means it's sort of net zero on a whole cycle basis. But it also is going to contribute to air pollution. So a lot of the pollution in homes is due to people burning biomass inside their home. So they have that trouble that the first step is usually to move from biomass burning to fossil fuel burning, which doesn't help the climate at all, but it does help local air quality. And it's only the stage after that where China is at the moment, where you sort of see homes moving from burning fossil fuels to maybe induction pans or other more environmentally friendly ways of heating your home and heating your food, which are more electrified and sort of like the whole process doesn't rely on burning biomass locally or burning fossil fuels locally. And therefore you can slide in renewable energy as the power source. So for China, we've seen some progress in trying to increase the level of renewable energy in the grid. India, as I say, is still at that stage where, like, they are putting renewable energy in, but they're also building more coal power plants, and it's not clear when we'd expect this to change. Both these countries now do have net zero targets, but neither of the net zero targets necessitate them to start reducing emissions immediately. So this is a concern in that it's not clear that whether their air quality is going to get better before it gets worse. Hopefully there will be political pressure and a political appetite to clean up the air pollution, which is, causing so many health problems in these countries and, of course, throughout the world. But it's just not entirely clear at the moment which of the political forces is going to win out in the short term to bring that down. The other effect from this burning of various different things is the production of aerosols and smog. So obviously these are things that are bad for the health, but actually they have a slight cooling effect on our planet. And because we're burning so much and have been burning so much historically, this has slightly helped to offset some of the warming effect from carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases. So as you see the levels of smog decrease, you will expect to see a slight increase in temperature. Not as much as the increase that you see from the continued fossil fuels, because the greenhouse gases accumulate, whereas the aerosols don't accumulate. They're sort of washed out of the atmosphere quite frequently, and they don't last very long. But on the whole, we do think that as we bring down levels of burning and levels of greenhouse gas, hopefully as we tend towards net zero, you will see some bounce back from the temperature cooling effects of those aerosols, perhaps a few fractions of a degree. Currently, this would probably not be quite enough to tip us over 1.5, but there are different estimates on that, and there's a bit of uncertainty. If you had a discussion about the Hansen paper last week, I guess you'll have gone into a lot of detail on this.
Now, using the language of climate conferences and international pledges, your group finds holes and improbabilities. You echo that back in the same language with the best models and techniques available. I almost wonder if your new paper isn't a bit subversive. Isn't it a case of the carbon budget like an emperor with no clothes?
I think we do show that the carbon budget is now sufficiently small that it's very difficult to use politically. And I think it's also fair to say that really few, if any, countries, certainly no major countries, are compatible with a 1.5 degrees climate target in terms of their emissions behavior. You can see that from our group, but you can also see that from many other groups, including the Climate Action Tracker, which has a sort of a very useful thermometer way of sort of and grading countries by what temperature you'd expect to get if other countries followed a similar level of effort. So I guess we're subversive, but we're not unusually subversive, I guess you'd say. We're here trying to do, we don't view ourselves as being here making political statements for the sake of making political statements. We want to produce, as accurate an assessment as we can. But at the same time, if it is the case that the emperor has no clothes on, then when you do the analysis, the conclusion is the emperor has no clothes on, right? Yeah, I think that's an unfortunate factor about statistics. It's very difficult to hide things unless you make a strong effort to hide things in statistics.
Okay, bottom line, what is the latest best estimate for a carbon budget for a chance at a livable world at 1.5 degrees C or a survivable world at least at 2 degrees of warming?
So the carbon budget for 1.5 degrees is 250 gigatons, which is 6 years. Of current emissions. For the 2 degrees budget, so you have the different probability targets. You've got a well below 2 degrees, which would be maybe like a 90% chance of being below 2 degrees. So for the 90% chance of being below 2 degrees, this would be about 12 years of current emissions. For a 66% chance, that would be about 23 years of current emissions. So for these, you're sort of talking about net zero dates that are double that period, because hopefully, as you go to net zero, you're declining. So for 23, you know, you sort of got 50 years to get to net zero. Maybe that's something that is not hugely different to what levels of effort governments are saying at the moment. But for 90 degrees, again, we're sort of talking about net zero dates before 2050. So not really compatible with the levels of ambition that we currently see.
You and your colleagues have been pretty busy publishing this year. What are you working on next, Robin?
So I'm working on quite a lot of projects at the moment. One thing that I'm excited about is looking at carbon debt estimates, which is looking at the amount of the carbon budget that's been used up by different countries and the extent to which that has an obligation for those countries to help other countries to remove carbon dioxide. I'm also looking at something that people keep asking me for, but strictly speaking, we shouldn't be telling you yet, which is when you say, what is the likelihood that we are going to be below certain temperatures? Well, the analyses we've done so far don't really allow us to give probabilities that we will do a certain thing in terms of emissions. But people would like to know that so they can sort of plan their lives around, you know, what amount of sea level rise they need to adjust for, what sort of warming they need to adjust for, all of these sorts of things. So I'm looking at techniques that might allow us to at least start answering that question in terms of probabilities of temperature rises.
We would all like to know. From the Center for Environmental Policy, Imperial College London, we've been speaking with Dr. Robin Lamble. You can find links to the science we discussed along with notes to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Robin, thank you so much for talking us through this.
Thank you for having the time to listen.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.